Wow. I don't know what to say now. Oh, that's right. Good morning, everyone. My name's Bob Mayer. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since May 29th of 1989. Jeez, I don't know what to say after Scott said all that good stuff now. I guess I got to say something to back it all up, but... Wow, thanks, Scott, for the introduction. I'd like to thank Denise and the group for asking me to speak this weekend and really appreciate it, and for Scott kind of taking care of me and leading me around and things like that. Don't let me get lost on the elevator or on floors, things like that. But if you do get lost on the elevator, you usually find other speakers, so that's where we hang out. I
have a note, just a couple notes up here just in case the train gets derailed along the way, because I don't do this very often as a speaker, especially in front of this large of a group, and what an awesome group it is. It kind of was bringing back memories of the International Convention. My first function as a trustee was to appear on the stage at the International Convention, and boy, I tell you, wow, you know, what a way to start. That was in my first meeting, so, you know, it was just, ooh, okay. But you know, the theme this weekend, A Design for Living, is just really special to me, and in the sense that once I found out that this isn't about stopping drinking and about living sober and living a life that's useful to God and to our fellow man, that a new design came about that wasn't controlled by Bob. So, but before I get going, I would like to introduce, since this is a service meeting, your new West Central trustee, West Central Regional trustee, is here, Ken Brueggemann. Ken. Get used to seeing him. He'll be around for 4 years. And I also serve, as Scott said, I serve Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and serve on the General Service Board as your East Central Regional Trustee. And it's a four-year term. I'm in my third term. I finished my third year and in my fourth year, and what a journey it has been. I sobered up in a small town in Ontonagon with four home group members, and three of them were women and myself. And so we've come a long ways to go to New York off and on. My home group now currently is in Franklin, and we meet in Franklin, Wisconsin, and on Tuesday nights. And if you're in the area, please stop in and see us. My current service position, as I said, was trustee, the General Service Board, but the way they make sure, well, you all make sure we stay busy. I also serve as a General Service Board Secretary. I'm chairperson for the CPC and Treatment Facilities Committee, and also a member of the Trustees Nominating Committee and International Committee. So there's not much free time, and for that keeps me out of my thinking and keeps me busy. Jack came up to me this morning, and obviously Jack read some literature this morning, and it talked about happy, joyous, and free, and hope you all caught that literature this morning and read it also. So with that, I always like to start out with a joke, and I'm not real good at remembering jokes, so again, bear with me. I have to look down at my notes once in a while, but and it's one of my favorites, and those of you who remember Cheers, great show, you know, remember Nom, you know, kind of wanted to be Nom at the end of the bar, or Cliff, and so the two of them are sitting at the end of the bar one afternoon, and Cliff is expounding in his male postal carrier uniform the Buffalo Theory to his buddy Norm. And here's how it goes. Well, you see, Norm, it's like this. A herd of buffalo can only move as fast as the slowest buffalo. And when the herd is hunted, it is the slowest and weakest ones at the back that are killed first. This natural selection is good for the herd as a whole, because the general speed and health of the whole group keeps improving by the regular killing of the weakest members. Kind of wonder, what do we, you know, you kind of got in them conversations at bars where it's going. Well, anyhow, here we go. In much the same way, the human brain can only operate as fast as the slowest brain cells. You're all getting there now. Excessive intake of alcohol, as we know, kills brain cells. But naturally, it attacks the slowest and weakest brain cells first. In this way, regular consumption of beer eliminates the weaker brain cells, making the brain a faster and more efficient machine. That's why we all felt smarter after a few beers. Just gotta love them things, you know. And I was in many of them conversations. So, you know, I'm going to talk about service, my service positions, and how I got those. But I'd like to go back and make sure that I qualify for here, and make sure you understand that I qualify. So I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I think I could sum it up that our design for living theme is covered in our three legacies of service. And those of you that are really, really smart, and those of you that understand the principle that if you put two sticks up against three sticks up against each other, which makes a triangle, that if one of those aren't there very strongly, you know, that falls down, the other two do. And the same purpose, our three legacies of service, of recovery, service, and unity, that if we aren't doing one of those somewhere in there, the other two are going to fall down. And that's what I found. And I think that we need to use, or my experience, that we need to use all three of those legs of that triangle in our recovery every day. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about, how many of you remember your first drink? Remember how it felt? Remember that feeling that we all got? I mean, I remember, and I was like 12 years old, and I remember that warm feeling, and all of a sudden Bob's come of age, and it just, wow, you know, and I was like, I was drinking with the big guys, and I remember that. And I didn't know why I remembered it, but I just remembered it. But how many of you looked for that same feeling every time after that, when you took a drink after that? You know, I kept looking for that same feeling, that same energy, that same power, that same feeling a part of every time I took that drink. And I didn't realize until I came and met all of you folks that's what this is about, that's what is different about us in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we keep trying to get that same feeling again after that drink. Now, I don't do that with other things that I drink, like water, root beer, or Coca-Cola, or orange juice, or anything. We're not looking for that inner feeling. It's, well, I'm thirsty, or I like orange juice in the morning, or, oh, gosh, you know, I missed a couple orange juices. You know, I mean, well, okay, so. But, you know, think about that with alcohol. It wasn't that way. And so that's the way it was. My drinking career kind of started that way. I was born and raised in Ohio, and that's okay. I guess I'm a Buckeye, as you might say, but, you know, I don't announce that too much in Michigan or Wisconsin. It's not real friendly to do that. But I've lived in Michigan most of my adult life, and then I moved to Wisconsin a couple of years ago. Along that way, I my family is not out. There's no alcoholics that kind of came forward and said they were. I know I had an uncle that sort of, nobody knew much about. He stayed up in the room at my grandmother's house, and, you know, he had some problems that, you know, we're a good German family, and we don't talk about that, and I think we all understand that, those of the German descent, that we don't air our laundry out there, and my family was no different. My first drinking, where I drank for effect, I got drunk. I don't remember what I did. I don't remember how I got home, and I woke up in the morning saying I would never do it again, throwing up, and missed a day of school after that, and I said I never would, and within a week I was doing it again, you know, and so that was my first time. I didn't know that I had all of the symptoms of alcoholic behavior that first time. I drank too much. I should have stopped. I did things I shouldn't have done. I don't remember those things that I did, and I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know those were all symptoms. Nobody said, oh, okay, here it is. So anyhow, I repeated that scenario many times over. Last night, some folks talked about college time. I qualified. You know, I made the dean's list every time. It wasn't the dean's list that they published in the paper. It was the one that comes on an 8.5 by 11 that's sent to your parents because they're paying the way and says 1.6 is not passing. You know, I think at the end of five quarters of college, I had a whopping 1.87% or 1.87 grade point, and I said I ran out of money and I went back home. And then my sponsor made me get honest, and eventually, some 30 years later, and say, no, that's called flunking out. And so, but you know, I lived under that's what it was. I didn't, you know, that's so. So anyhow, after a couple of years at home, and I. I continued with the drinking and things. I majored more in extracurricular activities in college than I did in my courses, but I ended up going back to college, and I said, I'm going to pass this time. And I wanted to get a degree in forestry. I went to school in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I said, okay, I'm gonna make this, and I did. I graduated. I think Jack was keeping track of how many years. I had 5 years for a 4-year degree also. I don't understand. My son went to school, and he was really smart, and he went 5 years, so I haven't quite figured out how they do that today, but you're supposed to do it in 4, so. Anyhow, I graduated from college with a degree in forestry, and I was really proud of that degree in forestry, and rather than go to work in forestry, I went to work for Chrysler Corporation as an emissions control engineer in Detroit. So there should have been another sign there that something's not quite right, but anyhow, I worked down there in Detroit for about 14 months, and I kind of saw the handwriting on the wall. I did some serious drinking. Blackouts were pretty common, as I kind of already led you to believe that, you know, that things weren't quite right. You know, I mean, you know, I took too long to go to college. I didn't do very well in college, and I went to work as an engineer instead of a forester. So anyhow, I went back to the UP, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and started with a job with the Forest Service. And my sponsor called that a geographic change, and I called it, I took a half salary cut in pay and went from a permanent full-time position to a temporary position. I said that was moving up, and he corrected me a few years later and said that's not moving up, that's called a geographic cure. So anyhow, I ended up back in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. After a short period of time, I met my wife after a couple of dates, and we ended up getting married I think 6 months later, and then my son was born 7 months later. And we had a pretty rocky marriage, and I had this concept of what marriage was supposed to be like, and she had another concept of what marriage was supposed to be like, and we were married for a short amount of time. And whenever there was any difficult times, I drank. I was a volunteer fireman, and I drank first Wednesday of every month for sure, because that was fireman's night, and I didn't go to work the next day. And I was a binge drinker, but I still always blacked out. I mean, that was common throughout the whole thing. If there was anything bad going on, I drank. If there was anything good going on, I drank. If I was going shopping with the kids in the car in the back seat, I always had a bottle between my legs and drinking that. I would count my blessings when I'd go in the ditch, and I would come back out of the ditch. And if I went in the ditch and stayed in the ditch, I'd say, wow, that was close, you know. And that's just the way it was, you know. No responsibility. And up to that point, nobody pointed out that I had a drinking problem. I drank like everyone else did in that small community in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. All my friends drank like I did. And so I didn't foresee any issues there. Eventually, my wife and I, we separated, and I started to drink pretty excessively at that point. And I kept the house all the same. I lived in a mobile home. We argued over everything. We fought. We separated in our divorce with knives and forks. We split them up and counted them out and made sure they were equal. So no resentments at all there. But I paid large child support. And I thought that was unfair, but everyone else paid that also, but it was still unfair. I was a pretty smart alcoholic, I thought, drinker. You know, I wasn't an alcoholic, and I didn't think I was. But I like to share one story in there to show that wasn't normal. And I lived in a mobile home, and it was obviously it was cold, and many of you come from the cold climate. And I had it figured out. I was living with a girlfriend most of the time, who was a bartender, which was a good thing. And I had it figured out exactly how many days I could get out of my fuel oil stove, I mean my furnace. And so with 10 gallons of fuel oil, I'd get about 2.5 days, you know, give or take. But I carried 2 5-gallon cans of fuel oil in my trunk all the time, and I got the fuel oil from the cheaper side, you know, which was the off-road fuel. How many of you carried fuel oil cans in your trunk, you know, because it was cheaper? Some of you did, yeah, all right. Well, then they know where I'm going. But anyhow, so when I'd gas up, put $5 of gas in the car, I'd also fill up the fuel oil cans. Well, it's smelly. Fuel oil is pretty smelly. So my car always smelled like fuel oil. And then when I get home, I had a 270-gallon tank. I never figured out why I did, because I never put more than 10 gallons in it. So I was smart, too, because I wouldn't buy a funnel for 99 cents, and so I'd cut the top off a gallon milk jug, and I'd stick that in the hole on top, and then I'd try to hit it with this metal gas can filled with fuel oil, and then so the fuel oil would spill down the front of you. And I never understood why I didn't get a date, but anyhow, I found out that fuel oil is not an aphrodisiac, so anyhow. So I always smelled like fuel oil. I was always spilling fuel oil down the front of the truck. My car always smelled like fuel oil. But it would always, you know, I felt, well, things are going okay here. You know, it could be worse. And I was still drinking, and I was staying over at the girlfriend's. And once in a while, I'd get in trouble, and I'd go into a blackout, wouldn't remember what I did. And so I'd end up back home. But, you know, I was pretty sharp here. You know, I had things protected. I wouldn't fix a faucet in my trailer for a reason, so it would always drip. So if the trailer froze, the drip would keep the rest of the, you know, water line from freezing. And things like that. So anyhow, one night I woke up and, well, I got sent home. I woke up in the morning, came to in the morning at 9 o'clock. It was a Wednesday morning. And all my clothes was piled in the middle of the living room floor, and I was on the couch. And I knew I was in trouble because I didn't remember how my clothes got there. I didn't know how I got on the couch. But with my keen sense of perception, I looked over at the kitchen sink right away, and I saw this long icicle hanging down. And I go, it's cold in here. And this was in December, latter part of December, when this happened. And so my water was all froze up, and I go, wow, you know. And so I get on the phone, and I call up my supervisor, say I'm going to be late coming into work. And he says, no kidding, come in tomorrow, you know, and talk to me. And I thought, oh, gosh, what did I do there? So I called the girlfriend up to ask what happened, and she hung up on me. And so I thought, well, this is really bad. So I thought, I'm going back to get a good night's sleep. Well, I used to have long hair and really enjoyed it and things like that. So I'm a product of the late 60s, early 70s and waterbeds. I had this covered too. I had this covered because waterbeds come with heaters. I had a heater under this deal. So I went back in and jumped in the waterbed, and it was a queen size ice cube, frozen solid. So a good night, a good morning sleep, or rest of the day sleep wasn't going to happen. So I went back out on my couch and cuddled up with all my sleeping bags on top of me and slept till later in the afternoon. So I thought everything was all figured out. Well, as a result of that escapade, I ended up talking to my supervisor, and they told me to go seek some counseling for my drinking and my behavior. And that was the first official help that I got in that whole deal. For my disease, and about 2 months later, 3 months later, it would have been in 87. I ended up at a treatment facility in northern Wisconsin, and thinking that I was insane, which I was, but I thought it was a mental condition, and I thought everyone was beating up on me, and as a result of that, I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous there. And I met a man by the name of Bob, who was married to a woman who was very similar to my wife, who had a girlfriend who was very similar to the girlfriend that I had, and who had the same troublemaker bill collectors, and everything was all similar. And I found out when he talked to me, I thought, now who called ahead and got this all arranged? And I related to him, and he talked about his drinking was his problem. And so I stayed there for 21 days, got out, and I decided that sober or dry, my design for living could still continue on a selfish, self-centered motive. I decided I didn't want to do meetings, and so I tried to stay away from meetings I made it a couple of weeks, and I went back to the girlfriend who was the bartender. I discovered NAs, and that was pretty new back then, non-alcoholic drinks. The only problem was I didn't drink them out of the can. I'd pour them in the glass and walk around in the bar with the glass, you know. So it kind of looked like a real one, you know. Tells me something where my mind was. I would sit in bars and I would drink shot glasses of 7-Up because I knew the bartender. When everyone was buying, She would pour a shot, some 7-Up in my glass, and everybody thought, oh, Bob's part of us now. He's drinking again, you know. And little did they know it was 7-Up. And you guessed it. That type of behavior will get you drunk again. I went to meetings, and I said everything was fine. I didn't work any steps. Didn't have a sponsor. Had some really good friends that I shared with, you know. And they usually had the same problems I had and did the same things I did. But they were in AA, you know. So it was okay. And at the meetings I went to, there was no big books on the tables. It was kind of like, bad day meetings, you know. The first person that tells a story, the next person tries to beat that one out, and then the next person tries to beat that one out. And by the time you get all the way around to the other end, you're kind of forgetting what the subject was, and everybody's just trying to top each other out. And and I had a guy there, and I was dating. Had a girlfriend in her Ironwood, and I had a girlfriend in the community I was living in, and then I had another one up where I was going to meetings. When I met in detox, and I learned about the 13th step, and I didn't know what the 13th step was. I thought it was perfectly fine. The sad thing out of that is today she's still drinking, and that was many years ago. That was over 21 years ago. And, that's sad. So think about it when you start messing around there. An old-timer told me that if I keep doing what I'm going to do, I'm going to eventually get drunk. And I told him, yeah, right. He said, I'll give you 2 years. I made it 22 months, exactly. And I got drunk. And I got drunk like you all told me I would. I did everything that I said I would never do, and I did it worse than what I did. That you said I would do it. After 3 months, I ended up back at the tables again, and both of my last drinks, the one in '87 and then this one in '89, in Memorial Weekend of '89, was a more of an emotional crash for me. I wasn't feeling well, and I had a lot of symptoms, but my liver wasn't enlarged, things like that, not that I'm aware of, but it was just I couldn't take it no more. You know, I just couldn't take it. I needed my will running my life. My design was not working. And so I came back to AA. I hung around for a year, and I attended meetings. We didn't have any service structure in our groups. There was no district meetings, we had, some of us had contacts, some groups did, but some groups had a GSR, but there was no GSR meetings to go to, or they didn't know about service. I came back, and I was miserable. I was literally miserable. I knew that drinking wasn't a solution anymore. That wasn't working. And I really wasn't liking what was being said at the meetings anymore. And I think Jack mentioned it last night about where you end up at that point. I ended up at that point with a gun in my mouth, about ready to pull the trigger, because I thought that was the only solution. And God intervened at that point, and I didn't pull the trigger. And I think my children had something to do with it at that point, but I didn't. And I decided that it was okay to be an alcoholic. It was okay to be an alcoholic. And so I came back to the meetings, not trying to be like everyone else, but just trying to be an alcoholic and what to do. And so then God started to do things. He put a man in our life, a fisherman that came up from Missouri, called him Missouri Mike, and he read the big book, and he talked. And I knew I'd never done a fourth and fifth step yet. I probably never done a first, second, or third either, but, I hadn't done a fourth. That was my thing. And so we were having this big discussion at a meeting one night, and at this meeting I went to on Monday nights, and they were all saying, no, you got to go back. You got to go back to treatment and get, you got to take your fourth step there. You got to do it there. That was everyone's experience. There was no sponsorship going on. There was nobody working with each other. Nobody talking the big book, working the big book. And that was the message, And Missouri Mike, he chewed a cigar. Well, he smoked a cigar, but chewed it most of the time. And he bit the end off of that thing, and he slammed his fist down on the table, and he said, by God, you don't have to do that. And he took me down. He says, come with me. And I went down to the little coffee shop in town where everybody can hear what everybody else is saying. I think every town's got one of those, And he didn't bring the new nifty little ones in. He brought this big one in with him. And he started to read to me out of it. And, you know, he went to the doctor's opinion and asked me about, you know, if I ever tried to drink just one. And I said, you know, well, yeah, you know. He's, no. Tell me really, you know. And so I got honest with the guy and told him. And so then he told me how to recover, you know, how to find another way of living that did not include alcohol. And so I proceeded on that course then. And it was really, and I'm really skipping a lot in between here, because it was a lot. It was tough to do in a community that was based entirely on someone's experience that was not involved with the big book. They got their experience through other means. And so I met some people that I know that their eyes just glowed, you know. When they shook your hand, they gripped your hand and they shook it and they look at you and they would just smile and say, "How you doing today?" And you knew they meant it from their heart. And I met some of those guys, and one of them was my sponsor, became my sponsor. And I prayed with him, did the third step with him. You know, I eventually ended up working the fourth step with him, but he didn't feel like he should hear a fifth step. I don't know why, but that was his deal. And so I ended up going far, far away, 60 miles away, and seeing a priest, a man of cloth, to tell my confession, I mean, my fifth step too. And that's the way we treated it back then. And so I came back and I felt really on fire. You know, I felt, man, something's going on here. And so I changed groups. I joined a small group on Wednesday nights. And we studied the 12 and 12, and then we started a big book study, a big book group, on which eventually ended up going into a study on Saturday nights. And there was about three of us that would do this. This other stuff didn't work for us. And so we started to read the book. I started to get involved with service. I got a call one day, and somebody said, "Boy, you know, we need an alternate DCM." I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Well, an alternate DCM serves as an alternate to the DCM." That's how much they knew about it. I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, who's the DCM? And what's DCM stand for?" And they said, "Well, why don't you give Tim a call? He's the DCM, and he can explain to you what a DCM is." And, I mean, we'd never had any district meetings or anything like that. And so I gave this guy a call. And he wasn't around. I left a message. And 3 months later, he calls me back and says, "I'm moving." Well, we all know. Everybody understands. You may not know what the job is, but everyone knows what alternate means. Alternate means when the first person leaves, you become it, you know. And so so I became the DCM for the district. We'd never had a district meeting, and I think the records went back 5 or 6 years. We had no GSRs. And so we had about 12 groups in the district, and the district covered about 60 miles by 50, 60 miles wide, and there was a lot of room, a lot of trees in between. And basically there was three communities where meetings were held. So I became the DCM. And at the same time, you know, in this divorce, there's this messy divorce. I fought to get my children, custody of my children, and I didn't get custody of my children. But they came back to live with me. So here I was, a single parent, began as DCM, and also got promoted in my workplace. I was marking trees in the woods. I still worked for the Forest Service. They hung in there strong with me. And I I began to do service work. And so the only thing I knew, because I didn't know any other DCMs, I didn't even know, I just got a service manual. This is the latest one. It was a different color back then because, you know, we got to keep things simple, so we change the color every year. But this is a purple one, and so I read what a DCM does. I found out DCM is a district committee member, and then I'm supposed to host or hold a district meeting of the GSRs. So when I found out there wasn't no GSRs, I mean, a couple of the guys' names on the list were dead, and it was like, we're starting from scratch. So I went around to the groups in the district and started to get names on a sheet of paper. And this is for those of you who are young, aspiring DCMs, and those of you that have been DCMs and trying to figure out how to get GSRs, maybe this will help. There's a thing called contact name, you know. In DCM world, that's synonymous with GSR, but anyhow. So get them to sign up as a contact, and that's what I did. No one would commit to a GSR because they didn't understand it. So I said, "Well, why don't you just be my contact person?" And so I just write them in as a contact person, and I'd send that off to New York, and the magic happened, and they got their stuff in the mail that they were GSR, and what could I say, you know? So we had our first district meeting, and I think like six or eight of the GSRs came, you know, and you know, so I got to meet people. It was really cool. You know, the other thing was I started getting out of my home group and home community. I started visiting, and I saw things that people did in AA that was really pretty awesome. You know, tradition in a community when I came in was at the end of the meeting, everyone stands up and you start saying the Lord's Prayer, and everyone opens up their wallets or their purses and they get a dollar out and throw it in the middle of the table. And I'll tell you, being a new person, not knowing anything about what was going on, I thought that was pretty weird, you know. Well, I went to a couple of meetings, and I saw people talk about the seventh tradition. So, of course, I had to read the seventh tradition to find out what that was. And then they also passed a basket. So I brought that back to my home group all on fire and excited and said, hey, you know, this is what they do over here. And so we had this deal, and we passed a basket around, and we said seventh tradition states we're self-supporting through our own contributions. And you know, I mean, our group was on fire and everything, and next thing is, how old timers are. And they stuck up and, oh, now we're only in the basement of a church. We're also a church passing a basket for collections, you know. And, you know, it never occurred to me that someone would take it that way, but they did. They read it that this was another church type of function, that we're doing collections in a basket. But you know what? Our home group conscience prevailed, and we kept doing it, you know. And today all the groups up there do that. And they also have a format that we brought back as a result of attending other meetings. So you know, if you're stuck in your own community and you're kind of going, geez, you know, travel around and see what's out there and bring it back to your home group and debate it and discuss it and see what happens. So anyhow, I served as a DCM for 3 years, and really nobody would be an alternate, and I can't imagine why, but and I couldn't get an alternate, so really I ended up serving out the rest of the term, and then I became the DCM. And I served for 3 years, and I started going to assemblies and had no clue what an assembly was, but I had an alcoholic car. Kind of all know what alcoholic cars are. You know, kind of like my alcoholic trailer. You know, the doors don't work, the windows are broken and everything. Well, I showed up my first assembly. I had no plans made to attend assembly. It was an overnighter deal, and showed up to Holiday Inn in Stevens Point. We climbed out of the windows, my children and I. Go up to the desk and says, I'm here for the assembly. And they said, somebody just checked out. We got a room for you. I locked my kids in the room and hung the sign on the door. It said, don't, you know, disturb and all that. And they stayed busy with electronic games and movies. And I went down, did the business at the assembly, and that was my first assembly. And, so those that I sponsor that have children, you know, they got to come up with a pretty darn good excuse not to go to an assembly. But anyhow, and they had a riot. They sat downstairs, and we kind of cleaned up a little bit. I had a plaid shirt that a tie worked with, and a sport coat that I wore in high school and things like that, you know. And I mean, but that's the way it was, you know. We weren't dressed up at all and things. So anyhow, I ended up at the assembly. I ended up becoming elected as a member of the finance committee. And we have a separate committee that does finances, and they're elected and all this other stuff. And out of that group, we elect our finance committee chair, and I became the finance committee chair. And you know, I had no clue that no one would ever trust me with money. My group trusted me with money, which was shocked me. But, you know, on the same level being trusted in Alcoholics Anonymous with doing things with money, I was also trusted as a volunteer fireman. I was also trusted to be treasurer of our fire department, you know. And we had a lot of money go through. And I don't think if I hadn't tried it in AA first, I could never have done it, you know, in with the fire department. Because, you know, Bob's will is just something else, different, you know, especially when it's untreated. And so, anyhow, there was a lot of parallels going on. And about the same time, I was feeling pretty good. I was sober about 7 years, I think it was. And my life was getting pretty good. I had a good job going on. My son had decided to live with me permanently. I was a scoutmaster. I started out being the committee chair, and you know how we all are sometimes, and we ended up being running the whole show. And you know, and I thought I was doing some really good things. I was involved in Little League and taking the kids, and I thought that was my calling in AA, was to go to my meetings and you know, and live a life, you know, serving other people. And I thought serving other people, I used that broad description and said that means serving the community and things like that. And so I discussed it with my sponsor one night, and my sponsor says, you know, you have the talent that a lot of other people do not have, and that's the ability to talk to another alcoholic. And, you know, they may be potential alcoholics, but they're not asking you for help right now. So you should really be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, you know, that changed my whole course of where I was going in my life. My personal design for living definitely changed after that. And about that same time, there was a book I'd bought in, three years prior to that. And a guy from California wrote it, and it was called New Pair of Glasses. I couldn't read that book. I just refused to literally read that book. And then one day I picked it up and I read it, cover to cover, boom, all the way through it. And in there was, I don't remember anything else about that book, but I remember one thing in there. He talked about his responsibility to go and carry the message to drunks. You know, and everything else waited. Family waited, all this other stuff. I mean, he was at the kitchen table, I think he describes on Thanksgiving dinner or something, gets up and leaves, you know, if it's time to do a 12-step call. And all that came together in a short amount of time for me. And you know, I think we were talking about when somebody lines things up and slaps you, you know. And I got slapped pretty good in that. And so I decided that was my course, that it was serving Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I started to pull out of all those other things. I did stay in the fire department because I felt I had a strong responsibility to the community because I was trained as a fireman. And I stayed as a fireman. But everything else I started to phase out of. And devoting all my time to Alcoholics Anonymous and working with you folks. And so out of that, I stood for, I didn't have a reason not to stand for area chair, alternate delegate in Area 74, which is northern Wisconsin, upper peninsula of Michigan. The position is shared. It's same position, same person. And so I didn't have a reason not to say no, you know. So I stood up there and stood for election and I had to introduce myself. They didn't even know who I was. And somehow or another, you know, I got enough votes to stay with the hat. And my name came out of the hat for area chair and alternate delegate. And I was elected to that position by coming out of the hat. And I had no clue what that was all about. And again, I have to tell you that, you know, my town was pretty small. We didn't have any delegates come out of our community. So I started to serve as area chair, alternate delegate, and again, I'm a book guy. I read the book, you know, that's what I did. I loved the older service manuals because they actually used to have directions in there that if you were elected to a position, they had somebody else's experience in there. So that's what I did. I started to go back and I'd read those experiences of an alternate delegate and what it was like to serve in that. So in our area, traditionally and normally, you know, you're elected delegate after 2 years unless you... whatever. So somewhere along the line, I decided it was not important for me to be a delegate, but it was important to me to be responsible and do a good job in my position as an area chair and alternate delegate. So that's what I did. I was probably the last person in the room to think I was going to be elected delegate when the elections came around. And I was elected delegate. I've seen that as a trustee in other areas where the delegate, the person, it's obvious to the, and everybody in the room, the guy's going to get it, he gets it on the first ballot, you know. And they're the most surprised in the room. And I just love that because I think that's what this is about, where we put everything else in front of our needs and our desires and our wishes. We put the service to the fellowship and to God first. And I've seen that over and over. So that feeling that I had, I've got to witness that again. And I started out as delegate, and I was a panel 50 delegate. You have to really watch what you wish for, and I'd like to talk about that because that was a time when we were working on the fourth edition, and I was doing a big book study with an old timer and on weekend big book studies, and I'd say there's no way I can ever vote for this book unless I see it, you know, and this was like in November, guess who ends up on a literature committee? I got to review all the stories, you know. I didn't just see the stories that went in there. I got to read the others that didn't make it, too. You know, and so you really have to watch what you wish for, you know. And so anyhow, I served on the literature committee, and I also had the privilege and honor of chairing the International Conventions Regional Forums Committee in my 2 years, and got to be involved in the selection for the 2010, this upcoming international in San Antonio. And it was just an awesome, incredible experience. And I'd like to just briefly go back to another part, because what I kind of want to really share is that people see us as we're serving others, and I didn't know that. That guy with the big cigar used to say that, you're the only big book that someone might see. Behave and do this, and do the best you can. My trailer was, I told you about my alcoholic trailer. Well, it was, In the wintertime, my son and I lived with some weasels in there, and we'd watch them change colors and the whole deal. And, it was kind of cool. It was entertaining. TV wasn't real good out there. So, and I'd hang blankets over the door at night, so when the cold wind and stuff and the snow. And I decided I'd get a house. And, I was pretty well off, I thought. I had debts. Everyone's got debts. And so I went to see the banker, and I told him, and he said, well, bring in your bills, look at them. And we brought in my bills and looked at them, and he says, your debt-to-credit ratio was off, or whatever that is. And I said, what does that mean? He says, you're not going to get a loan, you have too many bills. And I said, oh, man. So I went back home, and I was kind of bummed, and I talked to my son. So we said we were going to go back and get we could get a loan on the trailer to do some fix-up, put up a new door and put some new windows in. And, this is a trailer that was also on rental property, too. So, whatever we're doing, we're thinking we're going to have to move it. So anyhow, the next day I get a call from the banker, and he goes, come and see me. I said, okay, and so I thought, well, he's going to give me some bad news or something, So I go down to see him, and he says, there's a few people been kind of keeping tabs watching you over the years. And I said, really? This can't be good news. He says, I'll tell you what, they're interested in what you do to help other people. So they'd like to help you. I said, really? I said, what does that mean? And he says, well, they'd like to see your bills, and they'll pay them off. Well, I'm a keen guy. I said, okay, how much is it going to cost me? I'm thinking Guido and the buddies out back, So I'm just not there yet, I'm not seeing this whole picture. And he goes, he says, bring your bills in. No, I'm serious. Bring them in and turn them in to me, and we'll see what happens. And so I brought my bills into the guy, and he goes, I want you to know that this has nothing to do with the institution, with the bank. It's me and some people that I know and that are willing to help people like you. I said, okay, he says, you'll find out things over the next week or two, and the only thing you can't do is you can't talk about this, with anybody in town. And okay, I can do that. And this is a long time ago, folks, so don't worry. Some of the folks are dead that were involved, so anyhow. And so so I brought my bills off, about 10 or 12 grand, something like that. And over the next 2 weeks, the bills kept coming in, paid off. All them paid off. And wow, and then I get a call from the banker, and he says, come on down, we'll get you a loan. Got a house picked out. So me and the kids went and looked for a house, found a house close to school and everything, so we got a nice small house in Ontonagon that, as a result of, I think some of you folks probably, I don't know, but working with you folks and being of service, something that I would never, ever thought came true for me, and I was able to buy a house. And we could live in a house, and we get rid of the trailer, So you just never know who's watching. You just never know why we're doing it. And the trick in this whole deal is you can't preconceive that notion. You can't do it because of. I kept that thing such a quiet secret that I never told my sponsor about it. I was so scared of whoever. That's how fearful I was of that whole deal. I obliged him right down to the very. And I think I first talked about it. It was about 10 years after it happened. I think it's time to talk about it now. So to tell people that if you change your way of living and follow the steps as outlined in the big book and work with people, and put others first, people notice and things happen. But the first requirement is that we have to be thinking of service to other folks. So anyhow, I served as delegate for 2 years. One of the things that I did as a single parent and being in service and gone every other weekend and stuff, I love not only structural firefighting, I love wildland firefighting too. And I wanted to get into wildland firefighting, you know, and I just couldn't go, you know. You can't go somewhere and have a child growing up and say, could you take care of them, what, the 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you know. I tried that once and it didn't work. And, you know, it's not a very responsible thing. And also, when you have commitments to do workshops or chair things, you know, you can't just all of a sudden be gone. You know, I didn't feel that was right to do. And so I pretty much put that all on hold. And In September of my second year as delegate, you know, I started applying for some jobs and within the forest that I work on. And one of them was a fire management officer on the Ottawa National Forest. And brand new position. They never had one before. And you know, I applied for the job, and I applied for a, really get a little this, environmental coordinator, you know, write papers and things. So anyhow, you know, a big choice. But I felt I needed a change from where I was. So I got the job as a fire management officer. And I said, wow, you know. But, you know, I talk about this. The first thought wasn't thankfulness to God setting up the schedule for me. It was, whoa, I got that job, you know. And then about 5 seconds later, when you get that tiny tap, you know, then I go, oh, thanks, God, you know. But, you know, that, and I'm ashamed that it wasn't the first thought. But, you know, trust me, when I think about that stuff now, I put who's first is right. But anyhow, I started a job as a fire management officer. And I served, you know, and moved into that position. And I did some work at the regional level. Our region, East Central Region, has officers. And I became a treasurer for the region. And you know, I just tried to be of service. I kept paying back. I felt that I couldn't do enough to pay back to what had been given to me. And I traveled around and things. And my dad had died earlier in the early 90s, but my mom was still alive in about 2000. I think she died in 2001, about 2003. And anyhow, you know, she was down in Ohio, and it was kind of interesting because I had a commitment as a treasurer. There was two meetings, one meeting a year we had to make, and we had a meeting in Chicago. And I, you know, my mom was, had to make some decisions, and I was down for that week with my mom, and we had the meeting in Chicago with the delegates past and present meeting. And I was over in Ohio, and I thought, yeah, I'm you know, and I'm one of these guys, and Denise probably knows this already, but I kind of wait till the last minute to do things. I just do, you know. You know, I live a day at a time, a minute at a time, you know, whatever it is, you know. Which pant leg do I put in first? I learned that first, and sometimes I do that today, you know, sometimes. But I do have calendars and things like that. But anyhow, so I was saying, okay, I'm not going to make a decision about this deal. And on about Tuesday, we made a decision that we were going to pull the stuff on my mom and just let nature take its course. And on Thursday, you know, I was fortunate enough to be there, and she passed away. She left us and crossed over. And so I'm sitting there on Friday, and the conference is beginning on Friday, and I'm going, what am I going to do? Actually, Thursday afternoon I was there. And what am I going to do? Am I going to go to this conference, or should I stay here? So I said, well, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. So I'm going to an AA meeting. I thought, okay, I'm going to talk all about this deal. And so I go to this meeting, and I'm a half hour early, and I should have known something was wrong when I'm a half hour early. But I read the schedule wrong, and I show up a half hour early. And I'm thinking, I'm going to really embellish in this moment and listen to everybody, and everybody, oh, you know, no. Guy comes up to me and says, our speaker's not coming. How would you like to speak? Wow. You know, okay. You know, that's what I was taught. Do an open talk. So I talked that night. I didn't talk anything about my mom. Didn't talk anything about what was going on, but I shared my story with drunks. And at the end of the night, I knew very clearly that I was going to go over to Chicago and at least be there for one day. And so I went back home and back to my mother's place, and I talked with my family, and I told them that, you know, I really have a commitment in Chicago. The funeral isn't until Monday. Y'all don't need me here over the weekend. You know, I'll be back Sunday night in time for the showing and all that, and that's when my children was going to be coming. So I went over to Chicago, went to an AA function, you know, and gave my treasurer's report and things like that. And I found out that if we just hold off a little longer and don't make decisions, sometimes the doors open, you know. No is a very, very final word usually, you know. If you say no, someone does other things right away. If you say no to a speaking thing, yeah, people go find someone else. You can't come back a week later and say, you just can't. Same thing with service positions. If you're thinking about it, but you don't know for sure, I'll say no. Just keep it open. Keep talking. Keep listening. Because there is the message out there. If you're living a spiritual life, that message is going to come through, and you need to be ready to grasp it. And so, just like that came along, I had one where I talked about graduating from Michigan Tech University. You know, I had a dream that someday I'd come back as a professor or whatever I would be, with a 1.87 grade point. But anyhow, I'd come back and speak at this ballroom and be really cool, Well, my first speaking engagement at Michigan Tech was I was asked to be there as an AA speaker. Go figure, eh? God does have a sense of humor. But that weekend, it was my son's senior year of high school, and I said that I would go to all his football games. Well, all but, because their assembly was on a couple Saturdays, and I was going to miss his games. And I kind of blew this thing off, this deal, and I forgot about that. I'd said yes, and I hadn't conferred with my son. And, I all of a sudden, it was like I realized that, in July, that I'm speaking, and I'm going to miss another game. And Ben, I said, get your schedule and look at it. Let's see what we can work out. He kept forgetting to get a schedule, He kept forgetting to get it. And so I said, well, okay. So it got to be about the end of August, the beginning of September. He finally comes home with a schedule. I said, so when's your game? He had one game. Well, there's normally only one game on a Saturday afternoon. He had two games that year. I was speaking on Friday night. That game was on a Saturday afternoon. There ain't no way I could ever have planned that. And secondly, not only was he playing on Saturday afternoon, he was playing in a community right next door to there, 5 miles away. So my friends and I, we all went to watch him play football that day. And there is no way I could have ever, made that happen. I could not have designed that. There's no way. I mean, you can read all you want on pages 60. There's no way I could figure that out. So anyhow, so you just never know. You just keep doing things, and doing what's right, doing the next thing that's right. And so anyhow, I would like to, I started this job as an FMO, a fire management officer, and we started building a program, and I came time to decide whether I was going to put my name in for trustee or not, stand for a regional trustee. It was a big, huge hurdle, which I didn't think there was no way in heck I would ever be a trustee. No way, And it wasn't anything about me. It was just, it doesn't happen to anybody in from Area 74, and it doesn't happen from anybody from Wisconsin for the most part, And so I thought about it, prayed about it, talked to my sponsor about it. My sponsor said, you have a good reason not to stand? No, not that I could think of, except, April, when I got to be gone for 10 days for the conference, is the biggest time of the fire season in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I said, I got a job where that's kind of what I do. And he says, well, he says, yeah, I guess you're going to have to go talk to your boss about it. So I said, okay, And I'm not one that spreads around what I do on weekends with all my coworkers. My boss knows that I'm in service, and that's pretty much all, that knows. And so I went to see my boss, and I explained to her, what I was doing, and that this deal was coming up, that it's a 4-year commitment, that I'm going to be gone a lot, and probably have to take off every Friday and Monday. And she kind of chuckles, says, kind of like old days, but I said, but there really isn't a chance of getting this position, And so I said, okay, and she said, but I can't make that decision. You're going to have to go up and see the forest supervisor. Now, I talk to the forest supervisor about once or twice a year, and, he's the big guy, And so we make an appointment, we go up to see him, and I have to sit down and explain to him all about Alcoholics Anonymous, not only about my involvement and why I'm an alcoholic, but also what we do and what we are, and that we have a business, and we do things, we have a board, and we have directors. And so I sit there, and after about an hour, he gets all done, and he says, well, I'll tell you what, Bob. He says, if you can find the money, I'll approve hiring an assistant for you. Now, this is a matter of 3 years. We went from nobody in full-time fire on the Ottawa National Forest to not only me as a fire management officer, I had two full-time firefighters working for me. He's now saying we're also going to let you hire an assistant fire management officer. Now, this is a forest that has 3-4 acres a year burn, and we have 4 fires a year, so, big-time fire, And I'm thinking, wow, is this ever possible? And so I said, okay. He said, you find the money, I'll let you stand. I'll support you all the way. So I went back and sharpened my pencil and did what I could with the books. And I called up the guy who works in the regional office and budget. And he goes, He said, well, you know, we might be able to get you some more money and help you out and things like that. And I didn't tell him why. I just said, you know, we're trying to hire an assistant to back up for me and things like that. And so I got the money. They hired an assistant, and so I stood for a trustee. And his last words to me, my supervisor, was that you'll be elected. I said, what do you know? You know, there's no way. You know, there's all these odds. Well, you know, when it come time for election, I was sitting in the office. I was having a staff meeting. It was a fire day, and we were sitting around. We were talking about fire, and the delegate calls me on the phone and on my cell phone, and he says, you're the man. And I says, what? He says, you're the man. I said, I'm busy. I'm working. You know, it didn't even occur to me that he was at the conference. It didn't occur to me that anything. I was in the middle of work, and we were planning the day, and he goes, you've just been elected trustee. I said, no way, you know. And so then I hung up, and I'll call you back, and I hung up. And I told the guys, I said, I got to take a minute, and went out back, called him up, and, you know, it was true. it was true. And, you know, I still don't know how all that happened yet, you know. I don't know. My home group at that time was a small group, and I told you we were down to four people. And we affectionately called ourselves the Three Fallen Women and Bob, because there was three women and Bob. And that was my background. That was my backbone. Was my home group all the way, and my sponsor. So anyhow, been on this journey for 4 years. It's just been an incredible journey. It just has. And I guess that I'm here to tell you that there's no reason why not to serve. You know, unless you really, I mean, there's no reason personally for you not to be able to serve, unless there's something somewhere, extenuating circumstances coming at you. And I've seen beautiful work that people do. I mean, the people that set up this roundup is incredible. You know, the work they do, I mean, the commitment that they have is for a short amount of time, I'm sure, if maybe a year round. I don't know that much about it, but it's got to be equal to the commitment that we have as trustees. Different type of event, but they do. There's many, many things to get involved in. There just is. There's many, many things. And I think that the more we do on the end of service, whether it's sponsoring somebody or just getting involved in service, taking big books. My home group member one day, she was having a bad day, and she calls me up and she says, I had a bad day, Bob. I'm really sorry. I apologize, but, you know, I distributed all our home group literature out to the hospital. I said, how was that a bad day? And she says, well, I gave it all away. I said, we can replace it, you know, but that's what she did. When she was hurting, she went out and she gave literature away. She went out and met with people, and she felt better as a result of it. You know, she had a tinge of resentment. But in closing, I'd like to leave you with a thought that occurred to me last year as a trustee. And, I I'm really thankful for you all staying in here and listening, you know. And, it's just a really honor to be here and to talk to you folks. And to be able to share my story. I do have a little bit of 12-step stuff that I've done that I like to talk about once in a while, but I really have, I believe a lot of things have changed in my life as a result of doing service work. That man that agreed to give me more money eventually hired me to move to Milwaukee, and I worked for him until he retired. And, there's just a lot of little things that all line up that we don't know. And, I'm just here to see what the next ride is, you know, where the journey is going to take me next and why we're crossing paths, who I'm seeing and why and things like that and of service. But while I was in New York, I was hanging around one night, Southeast Regional Trustee and myself, and we were helping the staff person. It was about 11 o'clock at night, clean up the room. And we were helping put stuff away, and the busboy guys that work at the hotel, the busmen were coming in, busboys cleaning the tables, and this one guy come up and he says, was this an AA meeting? We said, yeah, and he just put his dishes in there and, you know, collected dishes and walked out, came back in a little bit later, and he goes, Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Yeah, you know, and he just continued cleaning, he walked out. Howard and I kind of looked at each other and says, wonder where this is going, you know, and, you know, maybe we need to, you know. Well, he comes back in again, and he says, you know, I owe my life to you guys. Really? He says, yeah. He says, I started working here about 8 years ago, and I drank every night, every day, every shift, and I used to fall asleep or pass out in the walls. I guess when you fold the walls back, there's spaces in there. And he'd go in there and drink a bottle of vodka and listen to our service meetings. And he'd drink until he'd pass out. And then he'd go, "You guys don't know what you're talking about." No, 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 you know. He did that until he got caught. His boss caught him one day, and he did that for about 2 or 3 years. But when his boss caught him, he remembered what we talked about in these rooms, what we talked about in a service meeting. And he says, "I've been sober, I don't know what it was, 5 years, 3 years, something." He was a GSR. And he says, "Someday I hope that I can be back here and be a delegate with you guys." You know, but so you never know who's listening, where they're listening at, why they're listening. Not only in our rooms, but also, you know, out on the streets watching us, how we live, how we act, and things like that. So I really do believe that, you know, another button I have says service is a secret, you know, truly is. A is not a spectator sport. It's one where we get involved. And for that, you know, I'm really grateful to have you ask me to come here and speak. And with that, I think I'm going to close. Thank you.